KZSU Stamford, 90.1 FM. I'm Mark Mono. This is the Henry George Program, a show all about land policy and politics. Today in the program, we have on Eric Goldwyn of the Transit Costs Project, here to talk about how to improve domestic high-speed rail project delivery. We're talking high-speed rail. We're also talking about exploding transit costs in local rail infrastructure and much more. This is actually part one of two. It's a supercharged conversation that went a bit long, so we're actually breaking this up. But without further ado, yeah, let's just get into it. So, Eric, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So the new publication is How to Improve Domestic High-Speed Rail Project Delivery from the Transit Costs Project. I think before we get into it, I mean, this builds upon previous publications from the Transit Costs Project about overall transit bloat. And I suppose, you know, before it goes into anything else, I mean, this, we don't need to spend a whole lot of time, but let's just talk about, you know, the motivation. What is the potential of improving transit costs and making, you know, I guess, high-speed rail more deliverable cost-wise and just, I guess, scale? I mean, sell people who aren't, you know, full hog, although I think most people, if you're here, you buy your whole full hog.
Absolutely. So the motivation for all of this is, I think it's pretty straightforward. My colleague, Alan Levy, about 10 years ago, maybe a little bit more now, had sort of been chronicling and collecting data on American transit projects. And Alan at the time was living in New York and noticed that phase one of the Second Avenue subway was an expensive project. They didn't know relative to anything else how expensive it was, but then in collecting data recognized that, oh, this project looked quite a bit more expensive than, say, something in France or in Japan or in a couple other places. Over that decade, Alan and I were working on some different projects together, and we had done a bus network redesign for Brooklyn. And after that, we'd agreed to try to do a research project on transit costs. And sort of the motivation is sort of what I just sort of laid out. But what we wanted to do is collect sort of as much cost data on existing transit projects. So we ended up collecting about 900 costs from 900 different projects. I think it spans about 187 cities in the world, just under 60 countries, I believe. And the point of collecting the quantitative data was just to get some descriptive statistics and say, no, this is the mean. These are the sort of low cost countries, the high cost countries. And then from there, sort of start investigating which countries are doing things well. And underlying all of that, the basic idea is this: we just want to get more transit infrastructure per dollar spent. So I'm a New Yorker, and when they built phase one of Second Avenue subway, it was very exciting, but it's three stations and about 1.5 miles. It took like 10 years to construct, cost $4.5 billion. And in a city like New York, I mean, it's not really okay, but we use transit, you know, it's a transit dominant city. But when you look at, say, Kansas City or San Francisco, which also does pretty well on transit, to be fair, you know, these long timelines and these high costs and these really short projects like the Chinatown subway, it's just like, it's not going to get us where we need to go if we're trying to shift people out of cars and just have alternatives. You know, like there's a whole sort of urban gestalt, I guess, about density and mixed use and all that stuff that feeds into our interest in transit. And we think that it helps make better cities than ones that are auto dominated. Even before we get into those types of arguments, we could just be doing a whole lot better than we're currently doing, delivering the projects that we already are delivering. And I think what we ended up finding, right, is that compared to our low cost cities, there are American projects that are, you know, 8 times, 9 times, 10 times more expensive. And when you get to multiples that are that high, you know, saving money is not really that hard. If the US were paying 20%, 30%, even 50% more per dollar, per project, versus Istanbul, or Italy or whatever, that's fine. It's like we're a rich country, it's okay. But when you see how these billions and billions of dollars that are, it's difficult to raise this kind of money, it just makes it hard to build a project. And so we just don't get as much as we could. And I think that's really, what was sort of, gnawing at us. And to just transition briefly into high-speed rail, it's pretty much the same thing, right? Like there are a lot of similarities. We can California High-Speed Rail Authority, I think, was created in 1996. We're in 2024. We don't have high-speed rail. We have a estimated budget of $150 billion. We don't have a funding plan for $150 billion. So I think, the point of that work is not necessarily specifically about costs, but it's not unrelated. And so I think it's a the natural extension of the work was getting into some of the intercity rail stuff that we're talking about now.
No, I think, I mean, there's a lot in the original publication, but I think one, if there's a brief takeaway, there's not one simple fix. It's a
No.
multi-dimensional problem.
Yeah.
And I think you can see it mapping on the high-speed rail. Basically, every dimension you mentioned in the original comes up here again,
Yes.
with the added wrinkle of federalism really bites you a bit more, of just getting all these. Usually, I mean, there are multi-state transit projects,
Yes.
but high
I
speed.
mean, but not like this.
Exactly. I mean, and again, you could be within a state. Texas could be doing stuff. High speed rail at Texas scale. You don't have to deal about state lines, but it's dealing with jurisdictions on a much higher scale happens more with a big project like this, and and novel agencies at that as well.
No, I mean, that's exactly right. So the dealing with the so obviously California High-Speed Rail is within the boundaries of the state of California, but it crosses through, Shafter and LA and San Francisco and Merced and Bakersfield and places I don't know the names of, King's Tulare, whatever it is. I know some stops. And to go back to the Second Avenue subway, it's fully confined within the boundaries of New York City, right? So it's one governmental entity that you need to deal with. I've done a lot of work in Seattle with Sound Transit, and I think I'm right when I say this. Sound Transit crosses 53 different jurisdictions in serving transit, and they have exactly the same problems that California High Speed Rail has. They have exactly the same problems that Second Avenue Subway, has. And Second Avenue Subway is, I think, it's all in New York City, that's true. But the entity that is pursuing the project sponsor is the MTA, which is a state authority, not the city of New York. These distinctions actually matter quite a bit. And it means, right, you have sort of at least these two parties that have to agree on things. And whenever you have two parties that have to agree on things and there's no force mechanism to say this side prevails over that side in the case of a dispute of some sort beyond, going to a lawsuit or something like that, there's a lot of room for deal making and for slowing things down and adding costs. And I think with California High Speed Rail, I mean, there are lots of examples we could talk about, but you see it even in, single jurisdictional sort of transit projects. And I think, to your point about novel age new agencies, right? Like California High Speed Rail Authority, like what the hell is that? Again, it's existed since 1996, that's true. But like, do they have the power to do stuff? Does the governor have to like back them up every time they want to have a fight with city X, Y, or Z? And I think with transit agencies, it's even more confusing. So like Sound Transit is a creation of three counties in Washington State. It's not directly, governed by the governor of that state. And so it's like, what the hell is that? Structurally, like we understand states, we understand counties, maybe we understand municipalities, but transit agencies are these like amorphous blobs in the mesosphere, and who knows if you should take them seriously or not. And to be clear, our argument is that people often do not take them seriously, which is why they have to spend a bunch of money, satisfying everyone else's needs before their own.
Very, very near to my heart. I mean, as far as just kind of strange structure, the BART extension in Santa Clara County, and that's weird because it's called the BART extension. It's not being run by the multi-county BART agency. It is a VTA, Valley Transportation Authority, the Santa Clara County Transportation Authority, with BART branding and some degree of oversight. And I think even it's there's all sorts of ways you can adjust. I mean, I think that a lot of times I can always use the heuristics. If there is more energy behind it to see something being done, necessity is the mother of invention. When people need something, there's at least kind of nice political pressures to keep it happening, as opposed to if it's a nice to have project. I think that's what makes novel projects more difficult, is California, we're willing to wait and hold our breath. Similarly with San Jose, it's really VTA doesn't care that much about serving people with transit. It has a tiny mode share. It's being run by city council people who don't really care about transit, who serve on the transit board. But I mean, the issues of the BART extension, cost overruns, but also I'd say lack of quality design. I mean, stations that are deep, deep, deep underground, it's going to take 7 minutes to get to the platform from the heart of downtown. I mean, the issue is, MTA, people need and value and really care about the subway in New York, but you get the same issues not only with cost overruns, but even just serving, I guess, quality transit. I don't, I mean, I guess it's orthogonal issues, and you even
No,
adjust.
no, no. So, like, accountability is really important, and like, it just does not exist, right? One of In doing the research on the high-speed rail side, I talked to someone who was responsible for inviting the CEO of the LTA in Singapore, which runs their transit agency, to like a convening in the States. And a week or two before he had to back out, and he sent a deputy, so not, wasn't, left in the lurch. But the explanation was there was a 15-minute delay on the subway, and I have to testify in front of, the National Assembly about what's going on. And it's like, okay, like, yeah, like that's it. That, it's like you're in charge. People understand that you're in charge. And when there's a problem, they like hold you to account. Whereas, like, in the States, it's like, what is that agency? Who's in charge of it? Like, who's on the board? The board is the governor, it's the counselors, it's the mayors. Like, no one can answer these questions other than like some dorks, and like that is, it's like a mystifying process. And like here in New York, we had this whole thing a couple years ago called, Cuomo's MTA, to like educate people that it's the governor, in fact, who appoints the most members to the MTA board in New York. And otherwise people are just like, what's wrong with the mayor? The mayor's not doing his job. And it's like, the mayor could do a better job, don't get me wrong, but in fact, the MTA is a state authority, and blah blah blah, all these things that are actually quite important, but no one really pays attention to. And I think that's the other thing about all this that I think is mind-blowing, is that these projects are without fail the single most expensive projects in like every city or state's history, right? Like the VTA project, I don't know what the estimate is. I think it's 13 billion, 15, whatever the number is.
It goes up
There's
every
no
week.
way, there's no way Santa Clara County has a singular project that has been as expensive. I would bet anything on that. I'm sure
Yeah,
I'm wrong now
pretty
that I've
sure
said
that's
that,
definitely
but
correct.
it's like, right. I mean, and it's probably like by a magnitude of 3, 4, 5x, right? Like, what the hell else are they doing in Santa? Like, I
I
don't
mean,
know.
there's
They'd
the
be like,
original light rail build out, but I bet
there's no
even,
way. But
yeah,
they, but like, but
exactly.
fine.
Yeah, you can do an entire system back then for, not much of a
But
system, but.
it's like, but that, let's say that that was even more expensive or the same price or whatever. It's like these transit things, they're really expensive, and like people should pay better attention. It's like if you, the most expensive thing that most people have is like, their house or their car, and like they like fix it and maintain it and get inspections and they do stuff to make sure it's like in a good state of repair. Whereas like we're like, okay, yeah, we're going to build this $15 billion project, and like we'll check back in 5 years and see what's going on. And I think on with high speed rail, it's like on an order that's 10 times that, it's $150 billion. And it's not a thing that anyone is super focused on. And I find that really strange. I think that does have a lot to do with this governance issue of like who's in charge of it, what level of government does it rise to? Like on the transit side, there are lots of examples of, agency X is having some sort of dispute, and it'd be really nice if the governor said, "Hey, stop jerking them around." But the governor's like, it's a local issue. Like, I'm not getting involved. And then, what your example in Santa Clara County is very common on the West Coast, where you have, elected officials on the boards. And it's like, what hat are they wearing when they make decisions? A lot of these, LA is famous for this, Seattle's famous for this. When you're building a light rail, a streetcar, a heavy rail, you're going to replace pipes, you're going to repave streets, you're going to do all these capital improvements to these cities that now the city doesn't have to pay for. And so there's a, I don't know if it's a wink and a nod, but there's an acceptance of, okay, fine, we'll spend some more money in my jurisdiction to do this, and then I won't make a stink when you want the same thing in your jurisdiction. And like that, all of that is maybe kind of okay on some level, but it's just like it needs to be more transparent, and like people need to know that like that's what's going on, because it's not that like transit itself is the problem, right? It's that transit is being used to solve all these other problems. And I think being more forthright about that is just important. Maybe because I like I'm into, I don't know, transparency and honesty. I don't know, but it seems like it's relevant and important.
Yeah, I feel like in the high speed rail, for example, I mean, you see the updates for the projects and they're doing impressive infrastructure, but every time it's about road grade separations. And I mean, and I think you can definitely make the case there, certainly I think high speed rail should not completely sever the state in half with no ability to cross from one side to the other, but it is, to a first approximation, a lot of the money is going into roadway projects. And it's not being framed as these are roadway expenses. It's being framed, oh, look at that train boondoggle. And
Yeah, that's not what it is.
and rhetorically, I think that also, what is our ability to talk about? I think the Transit Cost Project is great for being able to, I think, be granular and constructive. I mean, the new paper has five major deliverable kind of recommendations, but a lot of places you talk about, high-speed rail in California, you talk about the VTA project, it goes down to, well, you're either with us or against us. And the people who critique it largely are people who just want to kill the project.
No, that, yeah.
And it's difficult because, I mean, I think there should be a lot of place for people to say, I care about transit. I want to see this happen, which is why it should be done right, why our investment needs to actually go further. But we're getting less transit for a lot more money, and that's not good for transit. I don't
No,
know.
no, th no, th that that's right. I mean, it's interesting. I talked to someone who reached out and was like, "What I like about your work is sort of it. There are people on the left and the right, to use, not a lot of people, who like are attracted to your work and think you got, and the point that they were making is that sort of like." And as you're making, it's like someone could see the criticism as being saying, "Let's not build transit." That's absolutely not what we're saying. That's like, like I'm a transit rider. Let's see, I have my wallet here. Like I don't drive. I have my Metro card. I have my Omni. Like I'm ready. Like we're doing it.
Oh, you're not Omni first.
No, I do Omni. I have it's on my phone, so I have nothing to
Oh,
show.
fun. I love the physical cards. I don't know.
I do too. But I mean, Omni is amazing. Like, I love using my phone. It's just I happen to have a Metro card too, just because
Sure,
why
sure,
not?
sure.
Like, I don't drive. Like, and when I travel across this country, it's really hard to get anywhere, right? Like, I was in California for a conference not that long ago, and it was in sort of a hard to reach place. It was a transportation conference, by the way, and there was just no way to get there by public transport. And
Well,
I had
where
to
in
like
particular?
It was so it was outside of LA in it's called Lake Arrowhead. It's like around San Bernardino area. I don't really know.
Sure.
I was refreshing like there was like a group ride like website and like the day before the conference like someone posted a ride and I was like, oh, thank God. 'Cause like otherwise it's like I don't, I guess I'll take an Uber for like $200. Like I don't know what I'm gonna do. Like Metrolink goes like once a day or it just like did not really make sense. And it's just like it's so limiting and it's so infantilizing. Like whenever I travel or I mean I'm 42 years old. And I'm, you know, now with Uber and it's easy to get a cab in places, it's not as big of a deal, but it's like I'm very dependent on like the goodwill of someone to drive me somewhere. And like, you know, I should grow up and embrace driving more, perhaps, fine. But it's just like that's not the life I live. And I think, you know, there are other people besides me who would benefit greatly from just having better access to transit. You know, like children or older people who can't drive or people who don't want to drive or, you know, people who believe in like walkable mixed use cities and things like that. And it doesn't have to be everywhere. Like, you know, I think the car is like actually like an amazing thing and trucks are incredible in lots of ways. But you know, sometimes there's, you know, too much of a good thing in that respect.
I do wonder, a couple decades of Uber plus, a subsidized version of Uber at that. I wonder how much it's really harmed transit, because
Oh,
no,
totally. Sure.
I mean, I've myself only used it 3 times in my life for all emergency situations, as opposed to, I don't know, it is a backstop that
I
just
don't
it,
use it in New York,
yeah,
certainly.
it
I don't
just
use cabs
absolutely
in New York
it
either.
bleeds, as opposed to the I guess the frictions of old cabs. But I mean, especially when local city councils say, oh yeah, instead of investing in actual transit, we'll have a rideshare voucher program or something. That's just
Right. Well, I think, you know, going to, you made this point earlier about these city council members on the boards of these agencies. And I think this is like a critical part of all of this is that the people in charge is like, don't really have any idea what's going on and are not sort of studying it carefully. And so when someone offers sort of a silver bullet, it's like, yeah, let's try it. And like, okay, it didn't work. You know, like there are several sort of those voucher programs, you know, that end up being, you know, $50 a ride or whatever the number ends up being. And, you know, it's not sustainable. Like you have to end up subsidizing it, you know, even more, you know, than you were promised at least. And you know, I think that's the big issue. And I think, and I say this as very pro-transit, like we shouldn't just be building heavy rail and light rail places, right? Like it's appropriate when we're trying to connect, you know, this many people, you know, a certain number of people between, you know, endpoints. You know, if you need to move 5,000 people a day between 2 points, a bus will do the job. If you need to move 50,000 people, though, you need to take in, you need to think a little bit differently. And especially if you need to move 50,000 people, you know, during the peak period, like the only way to do that really is going to be with heavy rail. So, you know, I think there's a place for all these different modes in our sort of hierarchy of travel, but transit is really important. I think is what I'd say. And high speed rail, of course, as we're talking about
Sure.
high speed rail, is very important.
So before getting maybe into the different departments of the recommendations of this paper, I think just like of the politics, I do wonder, you talk about kind of the different nodes, everyone from the local city council people at a transit agency to the people in Albany, who administer
Sure.
MTA. I guess there is pressure. There is, what drives them, what isn't. I mean, Transit Costs Project, their mode is they're offering wisdom. It isn't, ideally people listen to wisdom and reform based on wisdom, but really politics demands force. And I
Yeah.
guess what are we up against? I mean, you have the asphalt lobby. I mean, it's
Sure.
when you touch stuff, you realize how much these people, they sprung into action for a for a land value tax study bill last year, which I wasn't expecting, but they are mobilized and they have so much money. You kind of realize in a different world, these contractors could be the people pushing for major transit projects. Right now, they certainly are neutral at best and hostile at worst. And you get, I guess it's everyone from just busy buddies, local merchant districts and everything else. I mean, I think that the San Jose project has turned out so badly,
sure.
largely because
yeah.
what's the path of least resistance? You know, I don't yeah. want to be yelled at by three people who run tiny shops, so I'll
yeah.
spend an extra couple billion here and there or something. You know, who's counting? I don't know. And I suppose, because I guess back to Singapore, I'm a bit of a weeb as far as it goes. I think there's things that make it work, you know, for Singapore. It's a city state, so you don't have the
sure.
same kind of
yeah, totally.
You know, upstate, you know, city kind of contradictions. But on top of it, I just love the way that it seems like there is a rationalization of how agencies serve a purpose or something, and they are accountable not only because they're designed that way, but they usually have quantifiable metrics for how well is this agency going, and you know, usually denominated in money when possible. But
mm-hmm.
it's difficult when you see, you know, an inefficient agency. I don't know. It's like, how do we get from here to there? It seems like if there's one thing I really, really worry about, it's even a bad agency like VTA, it isn't able to fix anything or do anything. But if you want to reform it, they have tremendous antibodies to go, like, to kill it in Sacramento. They have killed a
right.
number of reform bills. It's like, okay, well, how about you use that competence to actually do your job instead of, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, your point about sort of how we measure stuff is a really good one. I think, you know, we created that database so that we could quantify, you know, costs per mile or kilometer as sort of like a standardized approach.
Yeah.
But, you know, internally, the thing we talk really the most about is we often talk about cost per rider. It's a little bit harder to get that information because not every project tells you the projected ridership. But I do encourage you and your listeners to take the VTA project, that total dollar amount, and look at the number of riders it's proposing to serve and see what the cost per rider is. I mean, I've done the math. It's the highest cost per rider of any project I've ever looked at.
Yeah.
I think it was like $350,000 per rider. This is daily riders. And, you know, that doesn't mean anything out of this out of context, but that New York project, phase one of Second Avenue Subway, the most expensive transit project sort of in the world at that time, was $4.5 billion. And I believe the cost per rider was $26,000, which is actually quite good, despite its very high cost because it moves so many people. When you look at domestic projects in the US, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 per rider is pretty common. That's more expensive than abroad. And so when you then look at that VTA project at $350,000, you're just kind of like, what is going on here? It is scandalizing. I think the other piece of it, and it's a thing that we spend a lot of time in both transit costs work and in, you know, this high speed rail work, is, you know, the management of these projects is not always being prosecuted by sort of a subject matter expert who has done this thing before. I think one of the things that has been really eye-opening in doing this research is how willing we are to just hand the, you know, the keys to this machine to, you know, maybe a very nice person, maybe someone who's demonstrated competence in, you know, whatever domain he or she has worked in, but has never delivered a light rail, has never delivered a high-speed rail project, never delivered a subway project. I think, you know, if I were replacing the roof, like, I'm not going to hire a nice guy or girl who, you know, is really good at Excel. You know, like, I want someone who has built some roofs. And I think, you know, the willingness to do that, again, it goes back to this accountability issue, is that, like, no one's really monitoring this, and it's alarming. Again, these are really expensive projects, often the most expensive project in a city, a state, a nation's history, and we're just not putting together the A-team. Again, I think you could have a seasoned expert who's done this stuff working with these other folks, and then in the next project, those people then could become leaders. But, like, now they have that experience under their belt. It's, I mean, I'm sure there are other professions where this happens. You know, we were talking about baseball before this. I often think about as a Mets fan, you know, Jeff Wilpon is the son, was the son of Fred Wilpon, is still is the son of Fred Wilpon. But yeah, like he was like the president of baseball operations. It's like, what the hell expertise do you have, you know, to be doing this job that is like really important to like the functioning of this team? And like in industries where there isn't such obvious nepotism, like I don't think that exists so much, but in transit it does.
Yeah, how do you quantify who should be in the role and why? The White Sox appointed Chris Getz because of his ability to be a yes man, which is great. He's great at making his Jerry Reinsdorf's feelings feel better,
But at least he played baseball and like, you know, knows things. Like Jeff Wilpon literally, you know, I mean,
sure.
he played minor league baseball for the Expos, I think.
Yeah, but I mean, like,
Anyhow, so.
I think you should quantify these things. Like, oh, how do you deliver wins? How do you do? I don't know. It's
Yeah.
the quantification. I mean, principal agent problems are going to show
Sure.
up anywhere. But I
Yes.
guess having if you vacate the role as principal, if you're essentially like getting your car fixed, you write a blank check to someone, say, okay, I'm having someone else go to the mechanic and kind of just I'll hear them out, hear what they say. If the mechanic knows that's what's happening, they're gonna run you up a huge bill if
Yes.
no one is checking what happens. You see a VTA
But
get.
in your example, the mechanic at least knows what he or she is doing. Like in the example of transit
But they're
agencies,
not the
oh, sorry.
principal. They're just the
Right,
person you're
yes.
paying. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. If
But
you.
that's like when you hire a head of capital construction at an agency who, you know, has like some adjacent experience, you know, it's just like you're not giving yourself the best chance to succeed. Like some of those people might be great and they might excel and exceed all our expectations. And I'm all for that. But I think, you know, to extend the baseball and sort of sabermetric metaphors, you know, like you want to, you know, put yourself in the best position to win and you want to optimize on that OPS or, you know, whatever it is. And if you're putting someone in there who just like is not a slugger, you're just not going to get, you know, odds are you're not going to get the best outcome. And again, sometimes that star will, you know, regress, and sometimes someone will come out of nowhere and be a superstar. But more often than not, that's not the case.
Quantification question. You're talking about, kind of, cost per mile, and you can adjust. For example, the VTA project should have been a cut and cover project for much less. It would cause political disruption to do that, but it would have changed the. But I guess there was. It's like okay, if you don't adjust for that, Second Avenue Subway, is that could that have been cut and cover in this day and age, or like. I guess that this day and age being the last half century, or
Sure.
does it really have to be tunneling?
So no, I mean like you can do so our big recommendation is, you know, you should use tunnel boring machines for the tunnels, but for the stations you should use cut and cover methods.
Yeah.
So sort of excavate from the surface down to build your box. Second Avenue Subway, they could have done that. But one of the guiding design principles was minimizing surface disruption.
Yes.
And for VTA, that is also a guiding principle. And what I would like to tell the people in San Jose is that this is going to be very disruptive, even with, you know, deep bore tunneling. It's going to take a really long time, and you're going to have narrowed sidewalks and muck houses, and you know, you're going to hear the occasional explosion or, you know, whatever it is. The Second Avenue Subway project, it took 10 years to build. You know, they pursued this strategy of minimizing surface disruption, still causing great disruption. But then it like they extended it like, you know, like a dull pain where just like you're never getting over this. Whereas what would be better is, you know, rip the Band-Aid off and, you know, take some of that pain, but cut the timeline in half. You know, like my number one recommendation whenever I talk to different agencies or people doing these projects is like, I don't need to know anything about your project. Just cut the time in half. Like if figure that out. Like that's just do that. Like work backwards. You know, this guy Bent Fluberg wrote this book, How to Build Big Things, and he talks about, you know, going thinking from right to left. And he's like, start with your endpoints, and then work your way backwards, which is like a very reasonable way to plan something. And you know, There are lots of things we don't know and lots of things that we should be planning for. Fine. But what I definitely know is that it shouldn't take 10 years to build 1.5 miles of subway. There are a couple projects that are sort of in the pipeline that, again, just really long timelines. And it's just like, just cut it in half. Like, talk to your consultant and say, I need you to cut this in half. How do I cut this in half? And like, let that be the guiding principle. Going into the high-speed rail thing, the thing that I find so vexing is this project was supposed to be done in 2020. We're in 2024, which means we've had 4 years of all that car pollution, airplane pollution, road resurfacings, all that crap. And like, we're not, I think it's first, the initial operating segments was open in 2033 or whatever it is. And now we're, 9 years away. It's like, this is, it's unacceptable. Like, it's how, like, maybe the initial plan was too optimistic, like all those things, fine. But there's just the common sense test is like, we can build stuff in faster than, 1996 to 2033, 40 years, 37 years. I don't know who should be held. I mean, like, a lot of people should be held accountable on that one. I think, we're in this position now where it just everything takes way too long. And so we need to really focus on how do we speed some stuff up.
So, yeah, going into the recommendations, first recommendation is about kind of federal oversight, local experimentation, but
Sure.
it kind of builds upon, I guess, what are the strings attached? What's the funding attached? Like you talk about Amtrak, like there are capital subsidies, it's a $127 billion or something over all the years, but the point being made here is it is not a supportive continuous stream. It's a herky jerky stop start stop action, which doesn't build, I guess, the muscles that you need to kind of allow localities and kind of everything else to, I guess, be self-sufficient. It's almost a worst case of what you do with this. And this goes back to the, I mean, we're talking about high-speed rail, but this goes back to VTA again. When you have kind of grants as being the primary way that you motivate and control things, you get less of I guess vision as far as what do we want, what are the details, how can we execute, as much as how do we optimize for the best application for each grant. And I don't know, it's like the VTA project, I'll say it's bad in a lot of ways. It's very good at working with its federal, I guess, colleagues to get those grants, filled.
But I mean, it's a great point about, I mean, I'm not into grant programs because I think especially for transportation where you need to be thinking at the network scale, it's not a project by project thing. And so when you're doing grants, as you're saying, right, you're optimizing for the project. And so if you don't get a grant, like, why are you spending time and resources planning a network? Like, spend your time and resources doing the thing that's going to get you the grant, which is like this ACE project, which obviously is not ACEs. And then, like, if you want to get another grant, come up with another project. But like, thinking about a network at the outset is not really that important. And I think that's really bad. And I think for transit, it's not good. But I think when you're talking about like an integrated intercity rail across this country, like, it's awful. It's really bad. Like, we need a national vision. And like, there have been maps that have been made, millions of times. The federal government has maps, not just like, hobbyists. And to your point about Amtrak has been given a ton of money, it's true, but like, they're not necessarily given the money up front and saying, hey, give us a 10-year plan, we'll fund your 10-year plan, and like, that should, if that goes well, we'll talk about the next one. Like, when China builds its high-speed rail, it builds it in 5-year plans, and that allows them to plan what they're going to do over those 5 years. And I interviewed someone who's like, if you don't get your project done in 5 years, like, it's not so great for your career. Again, that idea of accountability, that idea of accountability. And I think what would be fantastic, and I think Amtrak, is doing a lot of really interesting things. They brought in Andy Byford, and they're gonna release a high speed rail, vision document in the, I think, somewhat soon. What you would like to see is they come up with their document and then they get some money to actually like translate words into steel and concrete. And then, if they do a good job, people are just like, okay, like let's do this again. But instead, what happens is, the politics are such that, fine, we'll give you $1 billion, $2 billion, which is great, but like that's only enough to do a smaller set of things rather than like this bigger thing that we're, we would like to do, and that would make sense. And again, with transit agencies, having a master plan of some sort is like not so common. And the places that do have sort of broader plans, Seattle is a place that sort of does have one, they're based on very little sort of like on the ground knowledge. And so they're just really like lines on the back of a napkin. And like that's also bad. Like you need to know what you're dealing with. You understand your geology. You need to understand, the right of way issues that you're going to encounter before you sort of say, hey, we're going to build this thing. In New York, the MTA, which I think is great and really exciting, is they now have a, a long-term document that identifies a number of different projects that they would like to build, what the cost per rider is, what the costs are. It's not saying they're going to build all of them, but like they have sort of a menu of things that they could do that fit in with a plan. When you look at sort of their old long-term needs assessment, the only subway projects were just Second Avenue Subway. Like there was nothing else in there. And, like that's bad. Like even in a city that has a lot of subway, like our city has grown in different places and ways. Like things should be changing. It should be a bit more dynamic than it is.
You should also always have a wish list that you can always extend almost indefinitely.
Absolutely.
There's always investments you could be making.
Yeah. And like, for the MTA, the sad truth is I think almost everything is, based off of like a 1960s, 1970s wish list. Like we haven't delivered on all of those things. So like we're still like, hey, let's dig up that zombie project and get that thing done. Like they're good projects, perhaps. But it's, not at all reflective of the current dynamics in the city. Or it's not totally reflective, I should say. I'm sure it is somewhat reflective.
So speaking of 60s and 70s, is the should we look at as being a better, I guess, system? I suppose the kind of metro level planning we saw in the Great Society programs. We saw a number of these built, obviously DC Metro,
DC, yeah.
and I mean, I guess across the board, Atlanta, Dallas,
Atlanta, yeah.
Baltimore, and I think some of these are more successful than others. But in a lot of cities just miss, I mean, this was also a window in which funding opened up briefly, then shut again. But it you really saw an entire vision of how a city could be transformed, as opposed to, I guess, compared to Obama era, what were the incentives there? It was kind of, oh, we're opening up a gate for streetcar grant projects, which I'll say as a Cincinnatian, I think we had the best streetcar of the bunch, and it did change. You got our foot in the door. A lot of issues where it was done, but I would have much rather had the 70s kind of vision plan of actually putting rail throughout the city. And I suppose there's a lot of issues of kind of how do you coordinate politics versus just the pure money, but I just think the overall regional planning, where we, I guess, what did we do right in the 60s and 70s, and is that the right thing to look back to, or should we go a different direction?
I mean, I think it's a mix, right? So I think if you go back a little bit further with sort of those traffic studies from the 40s and 50s, that are sort of the basis for, highways and roadways, there's a lot of really good work that went into that. It's like the cutting edge of analytics at that time. The IBM punch card is, and Detroit has a really good one. Chicago, CATS, the Chicago Area Transportation Study. They're flawed in certain ways, but they get at what you're talking about. They're these comprehensive looks at the region, and transportation, really is a regional thing, especially with faster travel speeds. So you really do have to look at it that way. We have these MPOs, Metropolitan Planning Organizations, but again, like what each one does is even more confusing than what we were talking about with transit agencies. Very varied, here in the Northeast, because there's like a legacy transit agency in this big city like New York City, and the MTA sort of like do a lot of that work. Whereas like in California, my understanding is like the Southern SCA, SCAG,
Skag,
Southern California Associate, whatever the hell that stands for, like they actually do quite good work. And so like they're all things in between. But yeah, I mean, I think ultimately what you'd like to see is some money for some planning to be like, okay, these are sort of the points we want to connect. This is the best way to connect them. And, obviously this is reflective of a time and place in history. And, if we go 50 years and don't do any of this, like maybe we should refresh. But, this should be guiding us as we, make our investments. Compounding all of this stuff is sort of like the separation between land use and transportation. Most transit agencies in the US have no power over local land use. And so, that means you're building a bus rapid transit, you're building a light rail, you're building a heavy rail, but you're doing it independent of, sort of the built environment. And it's like, that's a silly way to plan things. Like, if you're going to plan a heavy rail investment that's $5, $6, $7 billion, you might as well upzone along the corridor. You might as well do a couple other things so that you're drawing even more people to your service and sort of getting the most bang for your buck. And again, figuring out that coordination piece of like, the local city planning agency with, the state level transit or transportation planning entity, capital construction operator, whatever the thing is, it's like it's like a dis an uncoordinated ballet, and like we need that to be much more coordinated and work just a lot better.
It's a fractal, like every level. You have like the
Yes.
localities versus the regional government versus, obviously the state government, and then you have kind of the regional versus the federal level. But yeah, I think, I mean, I don't know, yeah, coordination between these jurisdictions, or perhaps, I think from every level, more automatic triggers. I mean, California came close to having kind of automatic TOD levels envelopes
Right.
around every major transit station, which is certainly a lot better than reforming the hearts and minds of a
Yeah.
million little governments. And
Totally.
I think this kind of goes too about just moving forward with the recommendations, kind of, standards about, high speed rail. If the feds, I suppose we're going to have a less centralized system necessarily than other countries have gone at it, but they still need to be able to massage and keep, I guess, interoperability, interfaces, and everything else across the board. And I suppose, yeah, well, what is to be said about kind of the best way to that I guess a decentralized but also consistent or at least workable network is going to be done.
That was an unbelievable transition. I'm
I
just
don't
very impressed. It's
know.
like Chris Sabo turning a double play. I think that's the coordination piece is so important, and it does touch on standards. I think, there was that report from, I think it was Seamless Bay Area, and it's like there are, I think, 27 different
That's the
agencies
number,
in the
yeah.
Bay Area. Something like, and it's just like, how the hell do you, I mean, like, how do you do that? I mean, you were just giving the example of VTA sort of killing all these different reform bills, but now imagine that times 27, and you can understand why, we don't get a lot of places. On the high speed rail thing, I think on the design standards, it's so obvious where it's like, if you have different gauges, so the width of your rails, or you have different railhead profiles, one's thicker, one's heavier, one's taller. If you have, switches that allows the trains to go from one track to the other that are designed differently, like it makes it hard to run a single solitary train across all these different systems where the signaling systems don't speak to each other. And I think in transit, you can maybe get away with some of that peculiarity because, like, fine, VTA, or, well, I guess VTA and BART are trying to do some stuff together, but they're not really, it's not relevant if it works with what's going on in SEPTA in Philadelphia, right? Like, it doesn't matter. There's no interoperability there. But, like Brightline West and California High Speed Rail, it would be nice if those were interoperable. Like, there's a whole project, the High Desert Corridor, that is planning to connect the two. And California High Speed Rail, they want to use what's known as UIC 60, the European standard rail. They're having some problems procuring it, so TBD on some of that. But Brightline West is like, look, we need to get this project done. So we're going to just use the standard American freight rail, which is known as the 136 pound rail. And whether or not rolling stock can operate, the same rolling stock can operate on both of those, like they're different. I mean, they're in the report, there's a drawing that we have of them, and we overlay them. I mean, you can see that the American rail is like, it's higher off the ground, it's a little fatter, I think. But like then it gets into the signaling systems, it gets into all these other, much more technically challenging issues that are not as easy to visualize in a report. And if you don't have interoperability, right, it means people have to get off the train. It means that you can't just run from San Francisco to Las Vegas. You have to, stop and switch trains. I think that's a missed opportunity. Like integration of transportation networks is sort of universally a good thing. I'll use the New York example. Like when they put in the Metro Card, to allow people to transfer from bus to subway at no additional cost, ridership, I don't know how much it went up, but it went up by a lot is the point. I should know those things before I say them. And I think we're right, whatever we can do to integrate Caltrain, California High Speed Rail, Brightline West, the San Joaquin's Metrolink, all these things would be really great. And we should spend the time and energy doing that work.
So right now they're evolving to, distinctly, but the door hasn't closed on the interoperability issues between Brightline West and California.
Right. Well, I mean, so they signed a memorandum of understanding pledging to work out some of the interoperability stuff. And my understanding is that there's some research being done, I think, by California High Speed Rail on, how to use the 136 pound rail with what they're planning. Because the issue is they want to procure this European standard, but when they put out a request for expressions of interest, they only got one response, which if you're into procurement, getting one response is not ideal. So I don't think I don't know. I mean, they would know better than I do. I don't know that they're convinced that that's the path that they will go. So they might have to switch to using 136 pound rail. But, there are these three sort of projects that exist, in more states of completeness, Texas Central, California High Speed Rail, and Brightline West. And the three of those projects sort of represent three different sort of standard families. The Texas project is, lock, stock, and barrel, Japanese standards, everything. Brightline West is sort of this hodgepodge trying to just mix and match whatever it can find, in America, living within the confines of Buy America requirements and, all of those types of things. And then California High Speed Rail is largely European. Like there are some, like in their standards guidelines, like they do look at some East Asian things as well. But I think on signals, on rail, on rolling stock, like they're largely leaning in the direction of sort of more European models. And look, we want all of these systems to talk to each other, and we want them to, be interoperable so that people can connect from one to the other seamlessly. Like we want to make this as, as easy as possible. So I think it's also like something that can be done really quickly. Like we don't need to like fight about, oh, what's the right standard? 'Cause like this technology exists. It's existed for a long time. Like if we made the terrible mistake of saying, we're just going to follow the UIC standards, the European standards, fine. If we're going to follow the Japanese, like we'll have high speed rail is the point. And like it will send us down a path. That's true. But it's not as if we are committing to a technology that is unproven and doesn't exist, like say Hyperloop or something like that. We are committing to technologies and design standards that have existed for decades at this point. And like we shouldn't be cute trying to like parse these things. Like, let's just get something going, and then like we can bring to bear our innovative spirit and disruptive whatever that you guys do on the West Coast. But let's just like, copy some stuff right now and get people traveling between cities at, I don't know, even 150 miles per hour, I would be very happy with.
Yeah, it feels like unfortunately with higher, better technology, you can't fix stuff. In the past, we had multiple rail gauges, and it's that
Yes,
was fixed. And like there's like stories of just they lined up a ton of people with sledgehammers, and one day they just fixed the entire gauge. But like I don't think you'd not be able to do that once we got into a couple mixed high speed rail standards.
And like,
Unfortunately.
and that mistake has been made historically. Like, the Europeans had that problem. Like, but then they were like, oh, we should focus on interoperability at the EU level. And so, like, there is still room for France and Spain and Italy and whatever to put their own customization on certain things. But as long, it's like the signaling systems have to speak to one another, and the gauge has to be the same, and the rail has to be the same. And as long as you're doing a couple of these things, like, fine, you can have different speed limits or different crash testing, worthiness levels or whatever you want to do. But as long as everything can run from one end to the other, like that's all we're looking for. Like, California might say, hey, we need to have bulletproof glass on our rolling stock.
Yeah,
Fine.
add-ons. Who? Yeah, that's fine. Do whatever. But part three, pretty obvious. Just the fact that this touched on federalism as well. If you have 50 different agencies, 50 different piece of workforce, we don't have the workforce, And I think just building the roster. I mean, I came from civil engineering, and I'll say it's seeing people just through the path of least resistance get sucked into transit. I mean, transportation engineering, roadways, and like it's like right now, you're going to get a lot of people who are kind of, moderately capable, get sucked into different, and we don't suck normies into transit projects, or just these people could be doing a lot more. But yeah, I think universities need to be part of this.
Where did you study civil engineering?
Vanderbilt University.
Was there any railroad engineering?
Absolutely not. It did not come up
Right. Well,
once.
that's the thing that I find so crazy. So I'm at NYU, and there's no railroad engineering. And in doing some of this research, there are only like a handful of programs in the country. Michigan Tech is one. UIUC, Urbana-Champaign in Illinois is another one. And like, that's it. But then you go to Spain, you go to China, you go to anywhere else in the world. Like, China has a, I think there's a standalone university just for high speed rail. So that's, and they just crank out sort of these engineers. And so I think there's like the very obvious point of like, we were talking about this earlier, where we don't send people who know what they're doing to manage these complicated things, which is a problem. So we should develop that knowledge and expertise. But also, like, the more railway engineers you produce, you also produce that constituency that can sort of advocate eloquently and, has skin in the game to say, hey, you talked about the asphalt lobby. Not that we should have different lobbies vying against one another, but it certainly helps, to have sort of a professional class that says, hey, like, we really should be doing more of this. And they can like lobby effectively, create, organizations that do that work the way AASHTO does for roads. And just in talking to people working on these projects today, just the roster is not there, the talent, the bench is not there. And you have, Network Rail from the UK is working on California High Speed Rail. Systra, the French company, is working on these projects. Sener is a Spanish company that's working on it. Deutsche Bahn, the German company. All of these foreign companies have set up shop to sort of impart their expertise, which is, we need it, of course, on our projects. But that also tells us some, that's feedback, right? That we just don't have enough domestic talent to do this stuff.
We have been talking to Eric Goldwyn of the Transit Costs Project, and much like these projects, we had a bit of overruns as far as our recording time, so we're breaking this up into
two episodes. This has been part one. We'll catch up with the rest of these recommendations with the upcoming episode. In the meantime, a reminder, all these episodes can be found at the website seethecat.org. This is a presentation of KZSU, Stanford.